Kolesky, and I wanted to talk today about some work we've been doing on the stellar components of nearby galaxy clusters. Some of you may think I've walked into the wrong conference, but I think it's important in the sense that we've seen that we need to understand clusters and cluster evolution to be able to get to the to achieve the goals of measuring cosmology that a lot of people have talked about. And even though the stellar components are just a minor tracer of the baryons in these massive clusters, I think I hope to convince you that you should care about these because they tell us things that are very key in understanding these clusters. So first, what's happening in these clusters? And we've already heard a lot about identifying mergers, identifying the shapes of clusters. And so let me just hammer that home a little bit, that galaxies really provide the best tracer of really seeing those sorts of structures. So here is a nearby cluster. And you can see it's got an elongated sort of structure here with several bright dominant elliptical galaxies. There may be another subcluster here with another bright dominant galaxy. And so even nearby, things can have very odd shapes, can have substructure apparent that will at least clue you in to what the structure of this cluster is. Now, just to bring that point home, this is a cluster you've seen a lot of this week already. And so we now know that this is a merger. But even in the galaxy structure alone, you could tell that because the galaxies are a very good tracer of the dark matter. So it's sort of poor man's weak lensing to look at the galaxy structure. And so you can identify clusters that are having some problems. Now, of course, this is a famous, well-known cluster. But there are other examples locally where you see similar effects. Here's Abel 754. The colors are galaxies at the cluster redshift. So you can see that there are two big lumps of galaxies. The contours are x-rays. And you can see that the x-rays are offset from either of those two clumps. So again, it's an example where there's been some interaction that has affected this cluster. This is the sort of stuff I think you could do with SC at higher redshift, where you'll have more SC measurements than you do x-rays. And so you'll be able to track mergers or interactions at high redshift much more efficiently than you will in the x-rays, which are hard to come by, as we just heard in Howard's talk. So I think looking at displacements between galaxies as a proxy for mass and SC signatures might be an interesting way to understand mergers, interaction rates at higher redshifts where you think those will be more likely and more common. Of course, the bullet cluster and this cluster are sort of nice poster childs for this. Often things are quite messier than that. Here's Abel 520, the galaxy image shown here with the overlaid weak lensing map, and then the weak lensing map with the x-ray image there. And so this is a complete train wreck. It's hard to figure out exactly what's been going on here. And again, this is at low Z, you expect more of these at high Z. Howard's 1.2 redshift cluster sort of looks elongated like this. And so understanding those sorts of systems is going to be key. And again, looking at the galaxies already from just Howard's images, you know that's a very elongated cluster. And so you might suspect that something like this is happening.
That looks different than Hank's map there. So which lensing data are you using here?
This is our own data from Magellan and combined with some HST imaging that we have. So it's different. So it does differ in detail from Hank's. And they had some bad ratios, different ratios in the galaxies to dark matter from clump to clump, and we're trying to sort that out.
Or is this no result?
No, there are differences. So some lumps appear, some lumps disappear. So we're trying to figure that out and sort that out.
Yeah, the lumps are not that critical. What's important, what's much more robust is the aperture mass.
That's right.
And so even with when we looked at Subaru versus CFHT results, the aperture mass changed very little. But whether you had a little contour that formed a peak or not.
Right. We're seeing the aperture masses change as well. So that's why it's still in prep.
Right.
Not every system that shows multiple clumps, though, has been interacting. Here's a group of groups that we found at redshift 0.4, the galaxies and the x-ray contours. And in the center of every x-ray one, you see a nice sort of central galaxy. So here's a case where, again, the galaxies point to some structure, but the x-rays tell you that nothing has yet happened. We think this system will merge to something of about half or a third the mass of COMA by the current time. So it's a nice laboratory to see what happens in the pre-cluster environment. But again, the galaxies already point to some, you know, interesting physics that's going to happen here. So this is part of our low surface brightness cluster survey, which I'm not going to talk about. But basically, we did drift scans over a large area of the sky and found low surface brightness bumps that were then followed up as clusters or groups. And these happen to be four nearby groups. All right. So the galaxies tell us something about what's happening now. Perhaps more interestingly, they can tell us about what's happened because they have a longer memory of interaction events than the gas. And so their structure in the cluster can actually tell you a lot about how many mergers there's been and what the history of the cluster is. And here's a movie by John Davinsky showing how the central galaxy builds up and how the halo of that central galaxy gets built over time. So if you see these large halos of galaxies or intercluster stars, you know that this cluster has suffered a lot of merging events. Whereas if you find some clusters where you don't see this, then you have a cluster that hasn't had that history. And in fact, there's quite a dispersion in cluster properties. Some have these and some don't have these. And so we did a survey of about 25 systems that have these large central dominant galaxies with a small 40-inch telescope and a drift scan camera, which we also used for the original cluster survey. And here's a little piece of one of these scans around one of these clusters. And the nice thing about drift scanning is that it allows you to get to very low surface brightness levels because you average over, as you're drift scanning, you reduce the pixel-to-pixel noise, and so you sort of have very well flat-fielded data. I just wanted to point out that it's done with a small telescope, and in fact, this could be improved a lot. You could imagine doing a lot more clusters than we did fairly easily. Here is one of the scans. I'm not going to go through the details of all the data reduction, but here is the brightest cluster galaxy and its halo. You can see it there and some smooth version there. And so measuring the property of the intracluster light is what I'm going to talk about. So here is the quote-unquote typical case where I show you surface brightness versus radius out the semi-major axis. And you can see we've divided this one up into two components, an inner component that's associated with the galaxy itself and an outer component that's the intercluster media, intercluster stars, or intercluster light. I use those sort of interchangeably. In this case, we're actually fairly convinced that they are two components because you see an ellipticity change and a position angle change in those components that you can model out. So with two components, these happen to be r to the quarter, the Vaucouleurs components, you can model both the ellipticity position angle change as well as the surface brightness profile. That's not always the case. Here, for example, I show the same galaxy ignoring the positional data. Here's the surface brightness profile fit with the surface profile, so a single component. So in this case, if you didn't have the position data, you might think that it's just one very large galaxy with this surface profile. So unfortunately, we don't always see this very nice ellipticity and position angle change. So we can't, in all cases, separate between one and two components. I'd say in about half the cases, the components are aligned. That is, this outer component, inner component are aligned. So we can't separate out unambiguously. In about 50% of the cases, they're misaligned. And so it's easy. You can separate them out. In those cases, it's typically about 80% of the light that's actually in this intracluster component relative to 20% in that central galaxy. So it's a significant amount of light that's out in the large areas, even though it's very low surface brightness.
Yeah. The envelopes that people have been seeing for a long time, or are you distinguishing between
these are typical CD envelopes? So these are quote unquote the CD envelopes, although those are at much higher surface brightness than what we find. And in fact, it's very hard to do this. The sky, where you pick the sky brightness dominates the area in this. And I think a lot of the early work had that problem. Photographic plates and those sorts of things, very hard to work with. So in some cases, in fact, in the first case we published, there had been claims of a CD envelope. We didn't see it at the brightness level that had been claimed previously. So I would take the earlier work with a grain of salt. I think the work that John Feldmeyer has done, that we've done, that Rebecca Bernstein has done, you know, is now competitive and reaches the levels that we see here. But the earlier work, you know, it's a little tricky. So how much light is there compared to the entire cluster mass, or at least the stellar light? Here's a plot that shows sigma of the system itself, so the velocity dispersion of the system, versus the fraction of light. And now I'm just going to talk about the combined light in the brightest cluster galaxy and intercluster stars, because we can't separate them out in every case. So the light in this central component over all the light. So here I have the central component plus the galaxies. And as a function of velocity dispersion, you see a very well-defined rise. That is, the more massive systems have a smaller fraction of their light in this central component. It's still significant. There's still maybe about 25% of the light is in the central component, 80% of which is in intracluster light. So if it is 25%, about 20% of the entire cluster light is in intracluster stars.
So means the BCG and the envelope?
Yes.
That's what the central component
is. Yes. So we haven't tried to divide them out because we can't in all cases.
And the velocity dispersion is for the whole cluster.
For the cluster.
But the second phenomenon that you were talking about, is that what you mean by CL? Or?
Yes. Yes. So in some cases, we can actually separate that out. And so I can tell you in those cases, it's about 80% of the combined light. But in other cases, it's hard to divide them unambiguously because we don't have the position angle shift to really break that degeneracy.
So where is the most of the mass, basically, in the ICL? Is it?
So yeah, so it's 80% in the ICL, assuming
the
same mathematics.
I'm thinking about the spatial distribution. Like, is it like total mass distribution?
No, so it's much more concentrated than even the galaxies and certainly than the gas. The half-light radii, I don't have a clock. The half-light radii tend to be 100 kiloparsecs, 200 kiloparsecs, somewhere.
So couldn't there be like a much more diffuse ICL component then?
It could keep going. Yeah, I mean it could continue out. We've just sort of.
So this could be an underestimated
size. Yes, that's right. I mean, we've extrapolated. We've done that test with the fitted model, and there's not much light beyond what we measure. But if you know, if there's a deviation from the fitted model, and it's you know, it's higher than that at large radii, it could be more.
I'll really find it hard to separate. Is that 80% number between the BCG and the ICL roughly constant over that range, or does that? Ratio.
No, we see, well, it's hard to break that down. I think I'd say that there's a tendency for these systems to be more BCG dominant, the lower mass ones. But there's a lot of scattering half far because we only have half the data.
Usually in all the previous ones, people find that envelope increases with velocity or mass of the system. So if you go to the more massive system, you have much bigger envelope.
Yeah.
Light on the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fractionally we don't see that, but it may be lost in some noise. The other thing to point out, so Paul talked a little bit about this relationship and comparing it to Lennon Moore's relationship. And the one point I want to make there is that we've selected for things that have these big central dominant galaxies. So one could imagine that there are points down here that we just didn't select for. And so perhaps this is just the upper envelope. Although that in itself would be interesting because it would mean that the stellar mass fraction of clusters changes depending on whether you have a central dominant galaxy or not, which would be an added complication to anybody's attempts to do you know, mass to light ratios for clusters and that sort of thing. And even at the massive end, there's still quite a bit of scatter that is unresolved. And I think someone made the point earlier about not only understanding the trends, but you want to understand the scatter. On this part, here's a comparison to some models by Purcell et al. In the yellow of the mass in this central component over the total mass, the same thing is plotted here, although it's plotted here versus a host mass. And so their dots are these black dots. The red dots are our data on the projected axes. So things seem to be hanging together, although again, they see more of a trend in the ICL itself than what we think we see.
150 kilometers a second. How many galaxies are in?
Well, so we don't actually have a full redshift survey of these things. So the galaxies themselves are done in a statistical way. But these are all well-known clusters. So my guess is there are at least 10 spectroscopic numbers. So as you know, as models like these show, it's starting to get at the history of clusters and understanding how the central components have formed. So next, we try to figure out who participated in all this. That is, do we actually understand the various components that are involved? Here, we've just talked about the central galaxy central component. What about the gas? What about other stars? Good question. Okay. So one of the things we did was try to do a census of the baryons in clusters. So we took the ICL light that we measured, the BCG that we measured, and the galaxies that are in those clusters. And we calculated the baryons in the stellar components of those systems as a function of M500. And then we took McLennan's gases for other systems. So one of the big drawbacks that we're trying to address is that these sorts of comparisons are not done on a cluster by cluster basis. So there's some measurements for certain clusters for the gas, some measurements for certain clusters for the stars, and there's not a one-to-one comparison. So one of the things you'd like to understand is does this scatter in the gas correspond to a flipped scatter in the stars? Does this cluster have more stars? Does this cluster have less stars? To see whether it's real scatter or observational scatter. And we don't have that yet, although we're trying to work on that. But anyway, the nice thing you see is that if we take the trend for the stars, so we fit the trend to the stars and use that trend to predict the stellar populations in each of these clusters, that's shown down here in the bottom panel. And we have a flat distribution with about 85% or so of the WMAP value. And there are big error bars, so it's not a highly significant discrepancy. But it looks like we've accounted for the majority of the baryons in these systems. So you can take the stars and figure out what the gas mass is. You can take the gas mass, figure out what the stars is for these sorts of systems. And you can think now that you can completely model these systems and understand them in their entirety. Yeah.
And that this was a 3-sigma discrepancy, what you're saying is not highly significant.
Well, it depends how you treat the errors and whether you're willing, how much faith you're willing to. So, for example, one of the issues is, do you accept these errors and then take the fit with the propagated errors, or do you say I should increase the scatter so that I actually have a low chi-squared model, those sorts of things.
Even within R of 500, the baryon fraction shouldn't be constant mean, it should be less.
Yeah.
So when you say it's less than WMAP, what do you mean by that?
That's the pure the universal value.
So it's
yeah. So one of these lines is bringing it down to what expectations. Right.
So that's basically the
other thing that there is a standard because if you don't have any cooling in your simulation, that's what happens. But if you have cooling, there are more baryons reacting, and so that could be. It's not clear what's going to happen. I think that's because simulation have more gas than plasma shot, or maybe comparable. So
in cooling simulations, you actually get cosmic mean within.
I think so. Maybe that's the comparison.
That's right. We actually find that the R500, it could be as much as cosmic mean inside the cluster R500, depending on the physical degree of uncertainty. At the level of about 10% in cosmic baryon fraction, not part of R500.
On the other hand, you also produce about factor 4 too many stars.
Sure.
In those.
Yeah.
So
that's right. So I think I would say that there's a range of about 10% uncertainty causing baryon fraction at R500 in simulations due to the cluster gas.
Yeah, I mean, there are clearly a bunch of effects. We see different radial profiles for the ICL, galaxies, gas, and dark matter. So things are clearly moving around relative to each other, and one shouldn't.
That's all redshift zero, right? Or
this is very local. And the another interesting thing is that a naive model where you build the big clusters out of the little groups doesn't work. And I think Mike wrote a paper on this as well. Something's got to be happening. Perhaps this is a sign that there's evolution, that the things that form these clusters are not these groups, they're more gas-rich groups. And the details of fitting this slope and understanding exactly what this trend is feed into those sorts of models, and that needs to be worked on. one way of checking all this and trying to see if the models are self-consistent is to look at the chemical abundances. of the ICM. And so here is a velocity dispersion versus iron fraction. So what fraction of the iron can we reproduce in simple models where we pollute the ICM with the stars? So here is the contribution from just the intracluster stars. So you can get roughly about 30% of the metals in the ICM just from supernova in the intracluster stars. And you know those metals have to get into the ICM. There's no question about having what fraction escaped from galaxies. They're in the ICM. Then you ask, well, what fraction then do I need to have escape from galaxies to get the entire ICM abundance, iron abundance? And you get a number of about 85% metal loss, which seems still somewhat high, but at least it's not 100% or over 100%. So that's a little bit better than other attempts to do this. The major uncertainty left now is in the supernova rates. And the supernova rates are uncertain by about a factor of 2 to 3. There have been, in fact, claims that the supernova rate changes as a function of environment, so that the supernova 1A rate is higher in clusters than it is in the field. And that might be, in fact, the problem that you see here. If you look carefully, we're over-predicting the iron and the low mass systems. So one of the ways out of that would be to say that the supernova rate is lower as you go to lower density systems. There are other ways. You could move iron around. We heard about iron transport in, I think, one of the questions before. So there are other solutions. But the next thing in really solidifying these results and understanding what the mass loss rate from galaxies is to better understand the supernovae. And so we're trying to do that. And here is one image showing you that we can find supernovae. This is before, after, and the difference. We're doing a survey at CFHT and at the Stewart 90-inch to find cluster supernovae, with the hope also of finding intracluster supernovae, since about 20% of the stars in a cluster are in the intracluster medium. We should find about 20% of the supernova. And here is a spectrum to confirm that this is indeed a type 1A supernova. So that's ongoing, and the rate we have, unfortunately, has still big error bars, and it's sort of in between the high rate that was one group predicted and the field rate that the other group has predicted. So we're still working on this, and hopefully we can break that degeneracy. The other thing now is, how did this all happen? So we want to put this all together into a model and understand what's happened to clusters, how do they evolve. And to do that is going to require all these complicated models that we've heard from. And pinning those down require some very well understood properties of clusters that we can match to. And so what I want to talk about the rest of the talk is about a scaling relationship that we've been looking into, relating not only clusters, but all stellar systems together. So I think one of the key things to do is not to think of clusters in isolation. People who do models think of halos. And halos span all sorts of masses. And so you would like to have models that span all sorts of masses and not think of clusters or galaxies or dwarf galaxies separately. Because one of the things you do to try to fix dwarf galaxies might break things that happen in galaxies or vice versa. And so you want a model that fits everything together. And of course, that's been hard to do in part because you don't have a single set of data to compare to really pin things down. And so I want to present some of the scaling relation work that we've been doing. So what's shown here is a scaling relationship that's reminiscent of the fundamental plane with the half-light radius along the x-axis, and then a combination of the velocity dispersion, a surface brightness, and in this case, a mass-to-light ratio term for these systems. These are all measured at the effective radius. So when I'm talking about mass-to-light ratios in all of this, I'm talking about mass to light ratio within this half light radius, not a total mass to light ratio. And I'll describe how we got this a little bit more in a second, but let me just show you where various populations lie. So here are elliptical galaxies, coma, local elliptical galaxies. Here are spirals. So for the spirals, they don't have velocity dispersion, they have a rotation velocity. So we just correct by root 2, as would be appropriate if they were the same kinds of stars sitting in the similar halo, but on circular orbits instead of isotropic random orbits. Here are dwarf galaxies. These include things like The very faint local group dwarfs, Draco, Leo 1, Leo 2, those sorts of systems. And it includes high surface brightness things like M32. They fall in the same relationship. There's more scatter because the observed parameters are more poorly determined. But on the mean, they fall in the same relationship. And then here are the clusters that we have from ICL measurements. And so what we've done here is I've taken the half-light radius of this combined component. So treating this whole thing, the central component, as a gigantic galaxy in a sense, doing the half-light radius, measuring the surface brightness, and then taking the cluster velocity dispersion as the proxy for movement. And this relationship is fairly straightforward. This is these two terms and this term just come from the virial theorem. And this term is the correction to just the pure virial theorem, simple-minded approximation. Now, as I said, this is related to the fundamental plane in some way. You see some of the same parameters showing up, although the coefficients now are just classic virial theorem coefficients. The reason for that, the reason why this is not quite the fundamental plane, is that in the fundamental plane, what happens is that for elliptical galaxies, this M over L term is a power law, well, it can be fit by a power law in terms of V and IE. And so when you take log of it, you can subsume that into these two terms and just change the coefficients. And then you end up with a plane. It's not that simple for the whole suite of systems. You can't just use a power law description of M over L. And in fact, it looks more like this, where you see a plot of M over L versus sigma. And so, for example, here's the range that ellipticals cover in this parameter space. And so over this range, you could imagine fitting a line to that, which would be the power law. And that's why the fundamental plane works. But if you try to fit a line to all this, it won't work. And if you try to do that and plot the fundamental plane, it really falls apart on you. So again, going from the very low luminosity systems in the local group all the way down to sort of dwarf ellipticals, giant ellipticals, and the clusters. And you see this behavior in mass to light ratio. And once you account for that, then all the systems fall nicely on the virial theorem prediction. What that means is that you know if you have a combination of these terms, you can actually predict things like mass to light ratio. Or if you have some other reason for thinking you know the mass to light ratio, you can predict distance, or you can which comes into the RE term in the previous plot, or you can predict velocity dispersion, and then you can compare and see if it's in dynamical equilibrium, has the right velocity dispersion, and so forth. So what I've done here, just to show you that something like that can be done, is I've taken the mass to light ratios from our direct accounting. So we have the stars, so I know exactly how much light I'm getting from those stars. So I know, and I have the masses from the X-ray measurements. So I can calculate a mass to light ratio, and those are the blue points here. And the black points are the points that we have from the scaling relationship. So, and in fact, you can do the same kinds of normalization questions. You can look at the slack lensing sources. You can look at systems that have very detailed kinematics that people have done two-dimensional kinematic modeling. And in fact, the mass-to-light ratios from this prescription agree with the independently derived mass-to-light ratios.
How are mass-to-light
ratios
for the rest of
the
stuff?
Not other clusters.
So in this case, the mass-to-light ratios I plotted are from a fitting function that we've derived for the data. And then we've gone through and compared. So, it fits in sigma, it fits a second order term, and it fits in R.
I'm trying to understand your last plot, because last plot was essentially the virial theorem, right? But I think all the masses are derived based on the virial theorem for galaxies, so I don't understand how you can.
No, so sorry. So, yeah, I went through this a little fast. What we've done is we've asked the question, so you can actually rewrite this. So I skipped terms because I thought I'd go slower here. But you can ask the question of what would it take for galaxies and systems to do this? And you just leave this as an unknown. And then you look at that behavior. Does it match anything? And that matches the mass to light ratios that are determined from lensing as determined from detailed kinematics. That's how we then ascribe this deviation that we fit empirically to mass to light ratio.
Are you using lensing or are you using?
No, so we're using our fit that is normalized from lensing and from detailed kinematic models.
Okay.
excuse me. So let me just, I'll just close and take more questions. Let me summarize. So why are we interested in stellar components? Well, you know, directly, they can tell us about mergers. They can give us a poor man's version of weak lensing. They're the highest resolution measurements we'll have of substructure and shape in clusters at all redshifts. They're the easiest things to measure, as Howard said, you know, high efficiency observations that you can do with relatively existing technology, so it's not a big deal. Second, what's happened? So I wanted to stress that the ICL is a witness to the merger history of these clusters. So if you're interested, if you think there may be dependencies on, you know, the parameters of the clusters you're looking at as a function of their history, you might want to look at the ICL properties, see whether there is a big central dominant galaxy, whether there is a big stellar halo. That might tell you whether this cluster has had a violent past. Then who participated? A full accounting is necessary to understand that you really know what all the phases are that are involved. And to do that with the stars, you need the stars to get the full accounting. And we've managed to, we think, get the majority of the baryons. And then this issue of accounting for the chemical enrichment is a way to close the loop and understand that you do have reasonable gas fractions, that you do have reasonable stellar populations, that you can, you know, understand that interchange. And then finally, how did this all happen? We need very tight constraints that have low scatter to really pin not only just trends, but understanding the scatter. And so the smaller the scatter is, the tighter we can constrain the models, because the less freedom theorists have to, you know, put in different things. And in like scaling relationships like I just showed you, you can actually make predictions on a cluster by cluster basis. The scatter is the same scatter as in fundamental plane, which is a factor of about 20% in any of these quantities. And so to within 20%, you should be able to get the velocity, the scale, the surface brightness, the mass to light ratio. That's a fairly tight constraint on simulations to do that from masses of 10 to the 15 to, you know, 10 to the 6. And so I think, you know, that might be a nice way to actually go. And of course, just like in fundamental plane, not only is the relationship useful as a constraint on models, but you can also use it perhaps as a path to estimating redshifts or sigmas. If you have some of the other information or mass to light ratios, you can turn the relationship around and use it to whatever benefit you know, you the most. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Do you know the color of the ICL? And if so, can you learn anything about the stellar pH and metallicity of it?
Yeah, so we find that it's bluer than the BCG. There's a gradient. But that could be
the same as the gradient within the BCG. Does it look like an extrapolation?
No, there's sort of a rise. You know, there's a bit of an inflection, but we only have about 5 or 6 systems that we have that. There's also been kinematic measurements, and you can see that the velocity of the ICL rises up to the cluster velocity in several cases. But the data are limited. It was that much harder work, and so there were only 5 or 6 cases.
I guess I'm a little puzzled, or maybe I'm missing something about this baryon fraction and the missing or non-missing baryons, where you're very pretty flat all the way to the small groups. I don't think I understand that. How do you get? I understand that the central galaxy and its envelope contributes relatively more in the smaller groups where you select them to have these big galaxies, contribute a little more than in the way. But when you look at the total baryon fraction in the stars in the system, I don't understand how these small groups have much more baryons in stars than in the bigger systems, because you just add a small contribution. We know what galaxies they are. In those small groups, it's still mostly spiral galaxies. In fact, the mass to light ratio of the stellar component is lower than in the richer systems. Adding this small contribution of the envelope, I don't understand how you get a major contribution to the stellar baryon fraction.
So at the very low mass end, we're completely dominated by that central. We're completely dominated, you see here, you know, 50%, for these low mass systems, 50% or more of the mass is in the central object.
And so, you know, the other galaxies in the group contribute, but they're a modest component. So I'm not sure.
Is this a cluster? I think this is more or less a giant elliptical, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. These are little groups, and these are starting to get to just very poor groups.
So I don't understand that how the variant flow, because we know that in a galaxy or in a galaxy plus a little neighborhood, you don't have the same total baryon fraction if you include gas as you have in clusters. But you're claiming it's the same. It doesn't.
No, so, well, there are two points here. One is that we actually cut off about here for the baryon plot because the gas measurements cut off at sort of 500 kilometers
per
second.
Okay, even if you start there.
So here, let me go to that plot. So obviously, you know, power laws are nice, but you can't extrapolate them forever.
But I'm looking at the bottom there. But if you look at the bottom curve, what you're saying that if you go all the way to groups that are only 5 × 10^13, mm-hmm. you can account. You have the same gas plus total baryons as you have in the rich cluster, and that I just don't understand. At the bottom line.
Right. Well, so it's these points, it's these gas points, and to this gas point, what I did.
In what way is it different than all previous measurements? How come the gas fraction is much higher there than in all previously reported groups?
So the gas fractions are from McLennan, so I haven't changed those. The only thing I've done is I've added our fitted stellar trend. And as Paul talked about the first day, other people have measured a shallower stellar trend.
Yeah.
And so if you take the shallower stellar trend, then this dips down.
And I don't understand how it can possibly be this flat, because we know the stars, we know their mass-to-light ratios. Those are mostly spiral galaxies. They have even lower mass-to-light ratio for the stars than in the elliptical galaxies. I don't understand how it can end up to a flat.
Well, so one of the possibilities, I mean, these are the values we've measured. So one of the possibilities is that these groups are atypical, because they were selected to have these very large elliptical galaxies at their core. These are all box more than class 1 and 2. So they start off with this very large elliptical in the center. And so perhaps we have selected things that have turned a lot of their gas to stars.
But
these are not spiral dominated by construction in a sense.
You can also tune the number of galaxies per unit dark matter mass if you want. That will help you as well.
But I just don't see how it will help. You're not matching the star.
One point also there is that those error bars of the star fractions aren't uncorrelated, right? Because you measure the sigma, you have to measure your R500, which determines your mass and determines your stars. The profiles aren't the same. So the error bars actually go almost almost parallel to that relation.
Well, I think it's a simple thing.
So,
is this line at the bottom flat or no?
That's the answer we want to know, but the reason why it's flat.
It doesn't make sense to me that it's flat.
I agree, and I'm saying one of the reasons why is that the reason it's flat is because of the steep relationship in the stars, and that slope is actually the same slope as you get from the correlated errors. So I think the slope is overestimated.
You can move these down.
I'm not sure. Let me ask it another way. Is the bottom line flat within the errors or no?
There it is, but I don't think that's correct, because I think your star line is too steep.
Okay, there you go. That's what I'm asking.
So the solution to this is to really go and do these on a cluster-by-cluster basis, because then you would have the X-ray temperatures for that system. You wouldn't have to depend on your sigma, and you could break that.
That would also imply that you don't have any of the baryons in the filaments and almost none. I think this picture doesn't make sense.
It is also a large plot. It could go from 1 to 1/3 across that if you just flashback that.
You could
go from 1 down to 1/3 and be totally consistent with those error bars, which would be about right for the local group, right? I mean, the local group, it's about 1/3 of the baryons that we know of, and we don't see the other ones. So.
If you look at the bottom line, to go to 1/3, you have to go quite a bit.
Well, I'm saying from the universal value down to 1/3.
So I'm thinking that maybe we should actually have you guys at a table at lunch.
here are some models that predict what the fraction of baryons and stars
is as a function of mass.
So you're using a theory to justify the data?
No, no, I'm just saying that it's not, at least it's not completely out of line.
Those are models that do not produce a focal gas function and X-ray luminosity and cell function?
Well, I mean, I think you can test them here. It's hard to know what the gas fractions are here, but here they work. I don't know about the whole range. But again, I think trying to map the full range and understand the full range is essentially where you can perhaps break these.
Regarding the total mass lock up in stars in a sort of, you know, big cluster of us. Can it go with maybe one or four? So take a solar cluster of 10 to 15 solar masses or so. So you or your plot seems to suggest that the total mass is definitely below 10%. So that's basically, how uncertain is this to any sort of unseen component in the intracluster light, and how much do you have to tweak or how to basically sort of change your fit that you have basically to sort of violate this 10% sort of upper limit on the mass that go into stars?
So you're saying, can we raise this up to here?
Or how much do you have to sort of, you know, tweak then your intracluster light, you know, and deviate from the fit there that seems to converge?
Right. So the fits on the ICL are dominated by the background. So it's all in how you set that background. We've taken a conservative estimate for that background, sort of estimated and multiplied it by a factor of several just to be conservative. And these error bars include that. So I don't think that errors in the ICL component itself, the way we've done it, could affect this. Now, if there's an additional larger scale component that we're not sensitive to, that's beyond the range of radii where we fit, then you could, you know, put in whatever you want. We don't have any constraint on that from our data. But if it is an order of the quarter law, then these errors, I think, are.
Okay, but it's fair to say currently there's no evidence for more than, say, 10% in stars for large cluster.
Yes. Given our data, I have no evidence for it.
Is the error?
So I think I'm actually going to declare lunch. but let's thank Dennis one more time.
Sorry?
Can you...